fly safety, sir.
This entire mission is a serious misallocation of valuable military resources.
Because I was inverted.
All right, everyone, the red light is on and we are recording. This is Mark back for another episode of the Veteran Semi-Professional. So today's an interview episode where I have a veteran on the show to talk about their life and career after the military, all in effort to help you if you're trying to figure out what are you going to do once you can put your hands back in your pockets, grow out your hair, and start wearing these things called quote-unquote civilian clothes. This is a show for you. So I bring people on. We talk about, you know, their personal transition. We talk about, you know, tools, tactics, frameworks they used in order to set themselves up in post-military life. Okay. So I'm super pumped for today's guest, Jack Ogden. All right. I've had a lot of guests on the show to talk about buying businesses in one shape, form, capacity or another. I've had some investors, lender, you know, multiple veterans who did some type of, you know, self-directed search to acquire a business. Jack is going the traditional search fund route. And if you have no idea what I'm talking about right now, and I threw in a bunch of terms that you don't understand, totally fine. We're going to break into all of this during the show. So Jack, if you can take a minute, introduce yourself, man, I'd appreciate it.
Definitely, Mark. And yeah, I don't have the radio voice that you just pulled out. I'm impressed, but hopefully have some useful experiences to share over the last few years. But yeah, my name's Jack. I grew up in Houston, Texas, lived there basically my entire childhood. You know, probably wished I could have been a professional athlete. That was not in the cards for me. So kind of got the Navy SEAL dream and went to the Naval Academy for that reason. At the Academy, I rode heavyweight crew. I studied economics and a couple foreign languages, actually, and then was successful in service selecting SEALs after the fact. And that kind of brought me to the military part of my career.
Gotcha. And how long were you in the teams before you got out?
Yeah, just a little over 5 years. So not the longest career in the teams. Had a couple, you know, overseas experiences. And then on the way out, I think it was an interesting place to transition into the private sector. I worked as like an innovation officer at our kind of two-star command, which is really cool because on the one hand, I think like the military does innovation very, very poorly, but it also was a great place to kind of go and think about, okay, could we use AI? And, you know, the answer to that is no, we don't even gather our own data and store it anywhere, but it would be nice to one day. And then same thing with like, you know, kind of virtual reality stuff. There's some real cool applications that could have for training. It would make it, you know, way, way cheaper to do a lot of like the qualification things we need to do for, you know, various people to deploy overseas. But yeah, it was kind of a good way to start wrapping my mind around maybe more of a like private sector skill set.
Yeah. It was one of the very first things I did in the Army after all, like my initial training and everything. So I think they're now have since shuttered in the Army. So it was the Asymmetric Warfare Group. I think they're no longer an operational unit. But essentially what they did, they were like the Army's research team trying to figure out, you know, best practices from the field, bring them into training and everything. Anyway, I got to be involved in this research study that was trying to measure, you know, the efficacy of using virtual reality versus live rounds for marksmanship training in particular. And, you know, I think at first glance, people hear that. I mean, obviously like training with live rounds is like always going to, you know, be better, but the Army was trying to figure out, okay, is this going to be, you know, could we do this at scale, have a more cost-effective manner? You know, it's a lot less resource intensive, easier for units to book and everything. And is it like, you know, a good enough solution for maybe most of the time? Not meant to like, you know, totally replace live rounds. But anyway, all that was a way to just bring in like, you know, the Army looking at virtual reality. It was kind of cool.
Yeah. So I'd say on that point, I think it's certainly like virtual rounds are the gold standard and would be awesome at the operator level. I think the question becomes more like, you know, if you're trying to run a, you know, a troop level movement with 100 people just to get a rep for like the ground force commander to, you know, interface with the air assets. That's this place where you can save so much time, resources, and kind of get a near perfect rep, you know, way more efficiently with some other options.
Yeah. Like when you think of all the resources and planning that go into having, you know, multiple assets on station and vehicles and people moving around, and then the simple, even just like the reset factor of like, you know, you're running a lane or something and it's like, okay, we got to go back and everyone like, we've got to move all the trucks, you know, back to the line of departure and aircraft's got to reset and everything just to like get another rep in. Whereas, you know, virtually it's just like, okay, hit the you know, control button, reset the whole exercise and keep getting some more reps in. So there's absolute value in examples like that. So I would like to ask people, can you talk a little bit about, like, you know, your personal transition from the Navy, kind of good, bad, ugly, sideways? What were maybe some bright spots that you might want to point out for folks? And then maybe what were some speed bumps also you might want to highlight?
Definitely. Well, the first thing I'd say is just maybe touching on kind of the reasons. I think there was a flavor of kind of the challenges that you look forward to as a kind of mid-career level officer, where it's less of the small unit leadership and kind of the exciting learning part of your career and more of the administration. So I wasn't thrilled about that, but I think my primary reasons were personal. You know, I share custody of my 5-year-old daughter, Lila. And I think it was just, I needed to have a little more control over my life and my time to maybe be able to have a little more say in where she would live and get to keep seeing her on a daily basis with kind of how parenting was working out. So that was very important to me. And ultimately kind of what led me to my decision. I'd say challenges, you know, I sometimes it's difficult to transition out. Like there's all these resources available like SkillBridge, and I just wasn't able to do that because we were pretty undermanned at the community where I was when I was separating. So didn't get to do a SkillBridge. But I will say I really enjoyed working with some of the, there's these groups that'll, like, I didn't do the Honor Foundation. I think they're quite large though. I've heard of like the Commit Foundation. I actually did a pretty small program called With Your Shield that was at the time affiliated with USC out in California, but I think now they're independent. And I would just say there's so many resources available to transitioning veterans if you take advantage of them. They don't always kind of seek you out. They try to, but I found those to be way more helpful than like the military's transition program. So it would kind of strongly suggest people to look into that.
There's a number of great programs that I've heard about kind of time and time again. Honor Foundation, definitely one of them. Commit Foundation for sure. I haven't heard it. You said it was called With Your Shield?
With Your Shield. That one's small, and I think it's okay. Pretty specific to like Naval Special Warfare. Although they started letting other people in as well, like maybe pilots and some people from the Army or Air Force.
Okay. And yeah, I've heard good things about 4Block also. Haven't really interacted with anyone from that organization, but know some friends who've gone through it. And yeah, gotten some good positive feedback on 4Block. So another good one to look to. And they're all kind of like the same generic flavor of some type of like a cohort-based programmatic structure around helping you exit from the military in a successful way. Okay.
So then I do want to say as well, I think – maybe even like my single biggest piece of advice in transition is like you can kind of hustle and cold outreach to people that have experiences that you think you might be interested in. And if they are a veteran, I found like there's no more group more likely to respond to me if I just hit them up on LinkedIn. You know, they've never heard of me, no real reason to talk to me, but they'll jump on like an hour-long phone call and answer every question I have. And like the value that's provided in my life has been huge. And frankly, it's kind of, I think one of the main reasons I was interested in doing your podcast is I know how valuable that was to me. And I'm hoping, you know, someone out there kind of might hear what I say and think that's valuable too.
That is a theme that has come up time and time again on the show of just the value of the vet net. And, you know, if I reach out to a Marine, they're going to say yes for the talk. And then, you know, the first minute we're probably going to, you know, jib and jab at each other. I'm going to make some jokes about eating crayons and he's going to talk about, you know, I'm fat and slow because I was in the Army or whatever. But after we get over like that minute of jokes, it's going to be like, okay, how can we help each other out here in a meaningful way? All right. Well, cool. So what was the plan? Like how did you kind of get started in post-Navy life? Like, did you have like a career, you know, kind of lined up for afterwards? Like talk me through like the kind of employment piece for you.
Definitely. So I had quite a poor plan and I think I was just going to go back to school. And I think that's where a lot of vets find themselves when they get out. You know, my skill set probably wasn't the most marketable unless I wanted to be like a warlord maybe or something in the Middle East. But outside of that, I you know, I just didn't have a lot of applicable skills. And, you know, your hustle and kind of the leadership experience only get you so far. So I think it makes a lot of sense for most vets to go back to school. And I looked pretty heavily and seriously into law school, into business school, into medical school even. I was like, you know, taking the MCAT, trying to learn like science classes, which was, I think, kind of directionless. And it was talking to a lot of veterans that kind of gave me a more focused purpose. Because I remember when I was looking into business school, you know, when you apply to business school, you have to select what career you want to do after you graduate. And it's actually quite an important part of the business school application process because, you know, if you go to law school or medical school, they kind of look at your grades. But I feel like for business school, they're looking at your career path. That's way more important right. to them. And there was an option on there called private equity, and I just ignored it. No idea what it was. It wasn't even on my radar. And that was ultimately the job I ended up doing when I transitioned. And that only happened through probably like the shaping force of 100 or so phone calls that, like, you know, either touched that industry or kind of pointed me more into finance or pointed me eventually into taking a private equity job.
No, that's great. And you're spot on like what business schools are looking for. It's like your grades and your test scores absolutely matter. Like they're going to look at that, but you also, they want to know, okay, what are you trying to do after graduation and how does our school fit into that plan? Okay. Because they want to know that like you are going to get value from this 2-year experience. It's a little bit different dynamic than, you know, like a law school or medical school where in order to be a practicing lawyer, well, I guess I don't think you actually have to graduate from law school, but you're probably not going to pass the bar if you didn't spend, you know, 3 years of law school. And it's kind of the same thing with like medical school. Like you have to go through this. This is like the gate you have to go through. Whereas business school, I mean, it's a kind of totally made up thing. Like you don't actually have to have an MBA to like really do anything. So they want to know that like, okay, you getting this 2-year degree is actually going to provide value. Okay. So first, cause someone else, you know, you said you saw private equity on a list and were like, I don't know what that is. I'm not going to do anything there. Quick kind of down and dirty version to someone who maybe doesn't understand or doesn't know what private equity is. What's private equity 101 here?
Definitely. And I would say private equity, I fit it on the spectrum of all the investing roles. There's venture capital, most people are familiar with. It's like you go to them and say, I have the best idea ever. We're going to make a remote control helicopter and it's going to, you know, send us information back. And will you give me, you know, $1 million so I can go build a prototype? And most of the investments there are going to fail. But every once in a while, an investment is going to be so big and you're going to have invested so early that that huge growth is going to kind of be all the returns from your investing. Right. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have like a hedge fund, which is public companies, fully mature, you know, large leadership teams. You're not going to be very involved in the product and relatively more stable. And then I would say, it's actually kind of a blended, blurred landscape because there's like kind of growth equity, which is closer to a venture capital type investment. But I'd say private equity, what it is largely, is for more mature companies that are not yet public and for the occasional smaller public company, like my firm did four take privates last year where they actually went and bought an entire public company and now nobody else can buy their stock because they took it off the stock market, kind of similar to how like Elon Musk did with Twitter. Probably most people are familiar with it in that capacity.
Right.
But the idea with private equity is less about valuing an idea and more about saying we want to be the private owners of this business, but we're going to value it as a mature company based on its cash flows, based on its growth potential, kind of looking back at its historical financial performance and more or less expecting that performance to continue. You know, there is some talk around being able to make operational improvements if you think you're more sophisticated than the previous ownership team. That used to mean for a lot of people, like, you know, just firing people and cutting costs that way. And that kind of gave private equity a bad rep. I found, you know, and it actually, it might be back to that environment today due to the cost of capital and kind of the challenges the economy is facing. This is, I guess, March of 2023 when I say this. But I'd say for a lot of the last decade, it was not about firing people. It was about really spinning up the growth engine and trying to make the company bigger by reinvesting into it. You know, if we can burn a little bit more money to improve our product, to hire more engineers, to improve our go-to-market motion with salespeople, we can create value here and make this a more valuable company than when we bought it.
Great overview. I think the easiest way to think of private equity is just, okay, it's a bunch of investors who have some money and like they're looking for businesses that are producing cash flow. Generally speaking, and these are going to be, you know, private businesses that are not listed, and they're usually, you know, beyond the, they're usually well into their maturity cycle here. Like this isn't going to be, you know, a tech startup that is probably, you know, pre-revenue or even like this is a business that's at least decently level profitable. There's a very wide spectrum of, you know, different strategies out there in the PE world. So I don't want to like try and blanket statement and say they all fall under this thing, but generally speaking, that's kind of the profile we're looking at here. So I'm curious as a, you know, former NSW operator who's calling in, you know, you, don't have business school, like what was the entree point into a PE firm where you're like, hey, you need someone to plan some Halo operations or something? Like what was the sales pitch there? Yeah.
Yeah. They just needed someone to like intimidate the management teams of the lower performing companies. So
they're like, we need someone who could be a warlord in the Middle East to come in here and just scare people. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, like some of our CEOs, they aren't taking us too seriously. You know, they're losing money. So we need you to just show up at the board meetings and be like really angry. No, so it was one of the people who kind of explained to me what private equity was. His name was Dino Mavrukas. He's a former CEO, former team guy, went to Wharton, I think, and worked in private equity a lot longer than I did before. I believe now he's doing a startup. It's like a autonomous submarine company in Austin.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
I think they're venture-backed and probably going to do some cool stuff for the military. We'll see. But I remember like how dumb I was, like how little I knew when I first talked to Dino. Like I asked him some of the like dumbest questions and he was just like, okay, like, thank you for saying this to me. Like, please don't ever say that again. Like, you're going to embarrass me. It's like, I was like, hey, like, why would I even like consider, you know, this job versus, you know, I could go to like business school. And he's like, look, just like, if you say that to someone who works here, they will be deeply insulted. Like, yeah. He's like, I don't mind it, but please, like, let me kind of explain this to you. And frankly, I think that really frank sort of like feedback and advice probably was like necessary for me to end up taking the job that I did. And I've grown to very much appreciate that. You know, I think I'm one of these people where I like to qualify my statements. And if you ask me a question, I'll try and give you like a non-answer where I say like, well, sometimes it would be good for someone to do this. And sometimes it would be better for someone else to go to business school. And Dino would be like, listen, if you get the opportunity, you need to do this. Like, don't think about it. Just do it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great to have that river guide there for you. And like that experience, Dino's communication style, I think, is like one of the great reasons to talk to vets at a particular target company, industry, school, whatever it is. I highly encourage everyone to also, you know, find some non-veterans to get like, you know, that experience as well. But I know like when I was looking at business schools and I was talking to veterans there, like they just gave me like a very like non-bullshit answer on like what school was like there, like what like the social dynamics were, what was the kind of like real culture at the school. And I really appreciated that and have generally found that like that holds true across people talking about, you know, working at a company or, you know, kind of certain industry or something like that. So it's good to seek out that, you know, very truthful feedback and everything for you. So kind of, can you first, you know, kind of describe like your role and like what exactly it is you were doing when you first started there?
Definitely. I mean, I was kind of a junior person on the team and evaluating investments. So I'd say, and maybe here, more of the inside type description. If you were to start working as an investor in venture capital, for example, like the universe of small, exciting ideas is tremendous. And the work generally involves like cold outreach and sourcing. And if you're joining kind of brand new, you're just going to be reaching out on LinkedIn, trying to call CEOs, trying to find companies that might be open to an investment. And you want to be like the first person to hit their inbox. And I think that's like most of the roles that would be open to veterans are that sort of work. For a firm like Vista, that's kind of so established and strong in the software space, you know, they do a few like multi-billion dollar deals last year. And if there's a multi-billion dollar deal, that is not a junior employee hitting up the CEO on LinkedIn and being like, hey, I'd love to chat with you about your idea. And like, can we set up a 30-minute phone call? Like, that's a deal that, you know, it's been whispers about it in the finance community for a couple years. You know, the people that have been working at Vista for 25 years or so kind of have their old friend that's kind of feeding them details, like, you know, kind of back channel. And then when they decide, okay, now it's time, we're going to sell this company, like there's only like five people who could write that check that they reach out to. And it's just like, all right, which of you five is going to kind of, which of you guys has an edge? Which of you guys, you know, is going to pay us the most or has some insight into this process that makes you guys the right buyer for this kind of business? So that makes my role very much so, you know, there's deals coming to us and we're just really digging deep into the financials. We try and talk to a lot of experts in kind of the market. You can pay, you know, like a lot of money to ex-CEOs of competitors or suppliers or customers and have these kind of high level conversations where you get to ask them, where is this industry headed? Like, what's the most valuable to you? Kind of like, what's the real value proposition here? Like, is this an interesting business? So it's much more kind of investment thesis type work. Like, why do we think this company is worth more money than we can pay for it? And what do we think we can do with our kind of operational expertise to create more value than the next firm? So yeah, I'd say for the whole time I was there, just digging into kind of company financials, digging into their kind of market, doing that research, talking to people in the market. And it was really a great place to go and like learn every day.
Fascinating. And were you... Do they have any type of, you know, training program to get you started or something? Or did you just kind of walk in the first day and they're like, hey, Jack, here's some shit to look at. Like, give us your best shot, man.
Yeah, they did. So I'd say for many people that want to do private equity, the path runs through banking. You kind of need to go to a bank. And it's almost like, I'd say, like, to use a real estate analogy, it's like if you're a banker, you're kind of like the realtor getting a commission, helping to sell the house. Whereas if you're working in private equity, you're like a real estate investor who's going to go out and buy a home. And the point there is that if you're a realtor, you're going to sell 10 homes for every one home you would buy if you were a real estate investor. It's a much bigger kind of decision to decide to ultimately buy one of these and own it for a few years than it is to just take a fee to help sell it. Right. And because of that, if you go do banking, the idea is you'll get a lot more volume and kind of deal flow, and you'll work on more deals than you would if you were buying them, because every deal that you work on is ultimately going to sell to somebody. Whereas if you're buying them, you're going to end up passing more times than you end up kind of completing the deal. So with that being said, for a lot of people that want to work in private equity, the way to do it is to go work in banking first, because a lot of private equity firms aren't going to get sufficient deal flow to train you on that financial analysis skill set. That logic breaks down a little bit for the kind of more mega funds like Vista. You know, if you have kind of getting close to like, you know, 100 billion or so in assets, suddenly you're hiring enough junior personnel, analysts or associates that you actually now have the resources to train them. And it's almost similar to a bank where you're going to bring them in and do like, I mean, there was a great training program at Vista. You know, some of the people were like, you know, big bank veterans, Goldman Sachs, et cetera. And they said the Vista training program to them was, you know, probably better than what they got in banking. Frankly, it was very intensive. It's like some of the harder days I've worked were like they do a simulated kind of live deal at the end where they're feeding you information and asking you to kind of provide analyses and make recommendations. And then you can, at the end, see what the real products were and kind of what the ultimate decision was that they made on this actual live deal. So yeah, the training was incredible. And I think it would have been hard for me to succeed without it.
That's good to hear. And I think that's a really important factor, especially in like, you know, the first maybe couple of roles after the military to find something that has some type of good onboarding training program, because you don't know what you don't know. And like, you know, for most of us getting started in that first career, like you probably have zero industry experience there. And something that's going to have a good training program, or even if you're just paired with, you know, a very good mentor or, you know, supervisor or something who can maybe make up for some of that, really important thing to look at as you're examining an opportunity, not just, you know, location and pay and maybe name brand or something like that. You want to know that you're going to develop in that role also. When did the idea of doing a search fund come across to you?
It actually happened kind of early. It was something I was aware of when leaving the military. Another thing that was kind of surfaced to me, you know, I forget who I was talking to. It was someone maybe at like Northwestern Business School. And I was just asking them about kind of what they were thinking, you know, coming out of the military, what job they might take. And they said, you know, I think there's some really cool things like search funds. And that was kind of my first exposure to it. There's a person, Mike Mare at Anacapa Partners, a search investor. And he's a Naval Academy graduate, was a submarine officer. He also was doing some work with the SEAL Future Foundation. So another example of how those little, you know, transition charities or veterans organizations can kind of turn up some interesting opportunities for you. And the SEAL Future Foundation, I think like this guy Joel at the foundation wrote my resume for me. He was awesome, very collaborative and great to work with. And just mentioned, oh, you should talk to this guy, Mike. And Mike kind of saw my resume and thought, oh, this guy might be someone who would be interested in doing a search. So I talked to him, you know, one time when I was leaving the military. And at the time, I actually thought like, man, that sounds like something I could do. Like I would be prepared to go do that right now. But I was also having those parallel conversations and had kind of been convinced that Vista was a good option and I should do private equity. So I kind of put it on the back burner. But I kept in touch with Mike over the next couple of years. And I think once I kind of closed a couple of deals at Vista and kind of got that experience under my belt, I then realized, okay, I could not have done this before. Had I just tried to do it initially, I'm very glad that I got to go and watch like pros, you know, really sophisticated investors. You know, I felt like every day I walked in thinking, I get this, I could do this. I would just see my, like the VP on my deal pull off some like really great maneuver over the bankers or something with like the opposing counsel. The lawyers would try and surface a problem and he would just shut it down. And I was just like, dang, I am like a rookie. I am not, I'm not a veteran in this industry.
Right.
But yeah, after a little more experience, it just got more and more exciting to me to maybe go back and revisit that and just maybe be a little bit like, you know, it's definitely a less safe outcome. But I'm excited kind of for the ownership of the outcome and to go take it at bat, even if, you know, I struck out. I don't think I would be mad at myself for having kind of jumped at the opportunity.
Right. Right. Okay. So, I've had a number of folks on the show. We've talked about doing like a self-directed search. We've kind of talked through the economics of, using an SBA loan and getting outside investors and everything. And I know we've gone over, we've gone over in the history of the show, we've gone over traditional search funds, but can you kind of quickly go through just the model and how it works from, your perspective as the entrepreneur and the relationship with investors and you're raising the fund and everything, just the basic mechanics of it.
Definitely. And I'd say traditional search is awesome. I would push most veterans into going into traditional search. And the reason is I think in traditional search, more of the challenge is around kind of the leadership strength that veterans are already going to have. They're not going to really going to have a boss because they're going to, with that SBA loan, have majority control of the company. It's kind of going to be an exciting way for them to go practice their like leadership skills on a small business and ultimately get like a great outcome. And I think it makes a lot of sense for people who kind of want to have more control over their professional life. It's kind of funny because I did a search because I wanted a little more control over my life. And then the first thing I did is I went and got a bunch of investors who can probably fire me whenever they want. So it's a little backwards to do a funded search, but there are some strengths there too. And then I'd say the differential challenge there is a funded search, you're going to be buying maybe a bigger company. So the challenge is now going to be kind of if you're able to run a fulsome, complex diligence process where, you're hiring accountants and lawyers and maybe have a more complicated company to dig into. And less of the challenge then is going to be like a leadership type thing, because if you can pull off the transaction, you're going to have a traditional board of directors. You're going to have all these investors who have seen hundreds of deals, hundreds of successful outcomes, and it'll be great to really give you kind of advice. You can reach out to them for anything. And then the downside, though, is they can fire you, right? You don't really have control over your time.
Right.
But the model, I'd say what you do for a funded search is you go out to a group of investors. There's some large institutions like Anacapa, I mentioned earlier, Pacific Lake's very large. And I'll mention the institutions in my cap table. There's also Miramar and Trilogy that I used. Yeah. And then this one group kind of blurs the line of institutions. They're called TTCER. Okay. They're the guys that bought the insurance company Assurion. And a successful search, the most successful search ever, probably by outcome, years back. And they now invest into future searchers. And then you also get a number of individuals in your cap table, which most likely are former searchers. And I generally kind of solve for people that worked in the software space because that's where I'm looking. But you raise money from these people up front. It's usually in the ballpark of 500K. And that is supposed to kind of finance your search for 2 years. It'll pay you a salary. It's not going to be as big a salary as you'd make if you would, go do the same thing for a large company. But the trade-off there is you have some more ownership. But yeah, you'd be surprised how much you can spend that money on expenses. There's some software and databases that are very, very beneficial to use that are expensive. Travel and it runs out quick and you have to kind of start thinking like an entrepreneur early on to budget that money accordingly and use it kind of the best of your ability to find the best business to buy. Maybe I'll take a break there and I can dig more into it too.
Yeah. Yeah. So just kind of like recap for everyone here, the basic mechanics of what's called the traditional search fund model. And it all comes from this research that was done by Stanford Business School. It's called the search fund primer. That's like the Bible of this world, if you will. Okay. Good thing to look into, but the basic mechanics is like, a young entrepreneur goes, usually raise around 500K, just like Jack said, and then that funds your expenses and, you know, your personal salary while you're looking for, you know, a business to acquire. Okay. That's just kind of the quick down and dirty. And I'll say, Jack, I don't know what your experience was like in fundraising, but, and all my folks that I've talked to who've been in there, like the fundraising part of this, like raising the fund is usually not a challenge. You know, much more of the challenge is the search. And then, you know, additionally, the operations piece in here. But I know at least one of my classmates at Darden was saying, you know, he raised the fund, ultimately returned the money back to investors. He went and got a job in consulting, but he was like, raising a fund was the easiest thing that I did at business school. Like it wasn't hard. Now, granted, most search fund investors, like they're looking for someone, usually looking for MBA grads, or, you know, probably someone like Jack who, you know, has some experience in on deals, you know, working in private equity. So you're not going to come straight from the military and go raise a traditional search fund, unless maybe you have some pre-military experience that's like really unique and special or something. But I just kind of want to set that expectation for people out there. So can you talk a little bit about the economics? Let's say you make an acquisition happen. Like how does the deal kind of structure work for you?
Yeah, I will. And the first thing I'll say, just to touch on kind of traditional versus self-funded search again, and kind of touching back to the reason that I stressed that a lot of military vets should probably self-fund. The idea with self-fund is maybe you buy a business that's around $8 million. And because there's that loan that you took out to own the business, kind of over the next 4 or 5 years, you pay that loan back. And at the end of it, now you just own this business worth $8 million, more or less outright. And it's kind of this like stable return profile where it's pretty easy to forecast and predict what the outcome will be. For a funded search, suddenly, you know, a big upside is you can buy a company larger than, you know, $10 million where you're going to get kind of capped out at how large an SBA loan can be. But the economics are now your investors own 100% of the business. And not only that, but they have like a preferred return. So if you don't, you know, exceed this growth target they hit, then just all the money goes back to them and you kind of get nothing out of it. But what you can do is kind of earn equity over time. And it's still going to be dependent on first making them a fair bit of money, you know, and that's the primary kind of capital. But after that, you can start to get more and more kind of vesting in three tranches. You get some for completing the acquisition. You get some for your performance threshold. You know, it's a pretty high performance hurdle, like a far higher return than you should expect investing in like the public markets or any other kind of safe security. So it can be very challenging and you have to do quite well to exceed that. And then you get some just for like staying with the business. But like, again, like warning is that all of this can be valueless, right? It's quite easy to have, you know, all that equity be worth nothing at the time of the exit of the deal.
Yeah, I think this route can be very attractive. The folks that I know who've done the traditional search, usually a couple different flavors that I see. You know, one, I know a number of friends who did it straight from business school, and most of them they're like, hey, I want to go do something entrepreneurial, but I also have maybe like a partner, a spouse, and a couple of kids or something, and I can't self-fund a search for, you know, 2 years. Like I can't go to my wife and say, hey, I'm just not going to take a paycheck after going to business school for 2 years. I'm not going to take another paycheck for 18 months while I look for a business to buy. And so like, there is like that little bit of, you know, financial security of, you know, getting, you know, get paid from the fund. And the other reason I think is like, you can just go after something much bigger, right? Like with an SBA loan, you know, you're probably going to get, you might be getting a small HVAC company somewhere. All right. And like that thing's probably not going to grow super big, but like can be a nice good business to run. Whereas this, now you're starting to get into something that's maybe doing, you know, 20 million plus in revenue. Like this is like a pretty significant business. And like that can be a nice, especially like earlier in your career, to have that experience. And then also kind of connect with those investors and show people who, you know, are probably 20 years ahead of you and are probably very wealthy, like, hey, I have the ability to do this, operate and perform and generate returns for everyone. So like there's pros and cons to both strategies here that's worth exploring for everybody.
Definitely. And I'll say what it came down to for me as someone who's now said twice to go not do what I did. But by my experience and knowledge is in the software space, and I feel quite confident that I could value a software company and very confident that I could not value a different company because I know what I know about software and I don't know what I don't know about the other industries, but I know that I don't know it. So in that software space, the multiples are so high and you generally are applying a multiple to the business's revenue instead of to the business's EBITDA or cash flow.
Right.
And because of that, if I wanted to buy a software business, then I was just going to need kind of more than an SBA loan. So I sort of got trapped into needing the funded search. And the deal with funded search economics is, you know, the investors are kind of only willing to pony up that much money for the terms that are kind of standard in the industry. And if I was going to need that money anyway, then it was not really a downside for me to kind of commit up front to those terms that were going to eventually be forced upon me.
Right, right. Okay. I'm good. You know, just before the show, you and I were talking a little bit about valuations here and everything. And so for the self-funded deals, you know, the valuation is mostly going to be around cash flow. Okay. And in my travels of looking at businesses myself, the term cash flow can mean a whole bunch of different things to different people as they're putting together, you know, their proposal to sell their business. So, you know, the two other terms you'll often see associated with that are EBITDA, which means, you know, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. So basically it's like the top line profit, probably easiest way to think about it before, you know, certain expenses kick in on the business. And then another good one at the lower end, it's called seller's discretionary earnings. Okay. And so for a small business, that's typically meant to capture like the total value to the owner of owning that business. Because very often, you know, a business owner will, you know, they are paying themselves a salary. But then also, you know, they're expensing, they're probably like leasing a car that they expense or like their cell phone plan gets expensed. And I mean, I looked at a business recently, the guy was expensing like $300K a year, like just to himself on top of paying himself and then also distributions and everything also. So it's just a way to capture like the total benefit to the owner of using that. And so those three terms can sometimes get used interchangeably almost at like that end of the market and, you know, heads up like, the account or the brokers always kind of hide things in there. So always good to have an accountant look at it and tell you what like the real number is because it's not always the marketed number. Can you talk a little bit about why maybe software companies are valued by revenue and not by cash flow?
Definitely. Yeah. And so, yeah, those three kind of values we just talked about are all less material to a software company. And I'd say, maybe if I had to explain kind of two terms that I could define that were like we would explain that difference. The first would be just kind of gross profit. And what that gross profit is, it's like, if you know, if you started a business and you're going to, you know, maybe you say you're Tesla, you're going to sell cars. Your gross profit is kind of like how much money is left over just for the materials to make those cars. So,
right.
You know, if Tesla made $100 million this year, but they spent $40 million of it on just the materials for their cars, their gross profit is $60 million. And that isn't indicative of how much profit they made because they have to pay rent and, you know, thousands of employees. It's all separate than that. But the number is important because it has to do with the scalability. It's like kind of if we grew so large that, you know, the employees shrunk to be like minute, kind of how much of that money would we keep on each incremental car we sold? And software is unique in this capacity because once you write software, you don't have to like write it again to sell it again.
Right.
You can write software one time and sell it to like every single person in this world. You could sell it to all, you know, 7 to 8 billion of them. And the only incremental cost you would have is like in the SaaS model, needing to host it on your server since you distribute to the cloud. So generally, I'm sure people have heard of like Amazon Web Services or Microsoft Azure. You can just, that is the only impact to gross profit for a software company. So because of that, you're going to see 80% plus gross margins. And that means this company is so scalable that as it grows, like all that new income is going to go straight to your kind of bottom line EBITDA, cash flow, profit type metrics. And then the second thing I'd say is net revenue retention. Because some, maybe going back to the car example, once you sell someone a Tesla, like now you have sold them a Tesla and that they're kind of out of the market for Teslas. You're not going to sell them a Tesla again anytime soon.
Yeah.
Whereas,
they're not on like a Tesla subscription where they're buying a new Tesla every month. If you have a friend
maybe
like that,
soon.
Please introduce me to them. I'd love to know that person.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Maybe soon. I think Tesla might would probably like that if they were just selling people a subscription to their Teslas. But yeah, on the other side, you know, if you start using Microsoft Office for your job and you're not using Microsoft Word and you use it for that first month, that makes you more likely to use it for the next month and the next month after that. So this idea is if you as a software company made $10 million this year, hopefully if your net revenue retention is like 100%, and often it can be over 100%, you can sit on your hands and do nothing and you'll make $10 million the next year. You don't have to go out and sell a bunch more cars. Like, your baseline is now the previous year. And what that ultimately means, right, is there's this idea that let's say you're a software company and you're losing a bunch of money, but you're making $10 million a year in revenue. The idea is that if you really, really had to, you could tomorrow fire every single person in your company and just keep selling that $10 million a year kind of customer base, and they're just going to give you $10 million year after year after year, and it's all going to be profit because your only costs are going to be hosting it on the kind of web until eventually maybe your last customer leaves. But there's like a company like Broadcom is a publicly traded company, and they make their whole like model is doing just that. They'll buy companies that are kind of on hard times, and they'll just kind of fire everybody and wait until the last kind of payer leaves. So they bought VMware last year, which I think is a good thing for other competitors in the endpoint management space, because it means that product is kind of going to be sunset.
Oh, fascinating. I didn't know people were taking that strategy. That's like pretty brutal, but also like, I mean, probably make a ton of money on it. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I could pull that one off. That's not my model. But yeah, I guess in summation, the idea then is when you look at a software company, you know this company can be profitable because of the model. And right. Instead, what you want to see is, okay, since we know it's going to be profitable eventually, how big is it and how fast is it growing? Right. And does it have the gross margin and the revenue retention that are kind of necessary to making this whole theory about profitability work?
Yeah. No, fascinating. So one last thing I want to touch on about search funds just before we get kind of get to the closeout portion of the show, Jack. So you're based in San Diego, right? And like the plan is you acquire a company and you would eventually run it remotely. Okay. And like you were, I think, you know, in our initial talk, you were able to kind of like work this out with investors. Like you kind of had some background in software investing from working at Vista prior to, you know, pretty tight thesis. And also like you can usually, you know, run a software company remotely. But was there any conversation with investors about location for like you physically, either during the search or post acquisition?
You know, a little bit. There wasn't too much. I think the investors are much more concerned with kind of like the industry thesis. But that is true that I think in a perfect world, what an investor would like to hear is you have no constraints other than finding the best company. And right. If you find the best company, you're going to move to, you know, the Arctic and running out of an igloo if you have to, because that's the best company. That's what we're all kind of on the same page trying to do here. But I also think investors are quite reasonable and they want a successful outcome. And they know that putting you in kind of a bad environment will not lead to a successful outcome. So I think they're, you know, understanding that some people, there's, you know, places in the country they just wouldn't want to live, you know, and especially if they have kids or they're married, they know it's a more kind of complicated process than that. What I've noticed, you know, is now that you go into the lower kind of market and smaller software companies, you know, the two most important employees in software are kind of your salespeople and your software developers. And both of those jobs have been remote, can be done remotely. And it's almost like to compete for talent in software, you have to offer your coders and your salespeople the remote option. And I can't tell you how often I hear, you know, CEOs or owners who are just not co-located with the team. I think honestly, that the bigger problem in the software space is not, are you going to move to, you know, Nevada, where this company is headquartered. It's how are you going to manage your support staff in India, your software developers in Ukraine, and, you know, your customer support people that are in South America. You know, you see that a lot. And at that point, it becomes like there is no, you know, solving this location problem. You're just going to have to kind of operate in the uncertainty of a distributed team.
Yeah. And it's kind of funny, like there's three geographic locations or like the ones I hear associated with those different, you know, those different areas or the functions all the time. Yeah. You'll see a lot of Eastern Europeans who do some like offshore remote development, lots of stuff gets outsourced to India, but then a lot of people want to go to, you know, Central and South America for customer service because it's on the same time zone as the United States. And usually it's a little bit closer language wise too, sometimes for folks. Well, super cool. So Jack, really great talking to you. We're kind of winding down to the last few minutes of the show. And so in a minute, I'm going to pass it back over to you. Just provide any last thoughts, parting shots, words of wisdom, if you were, for the crowd. But before I do, there's a question I always ask my guests. So if you think back to your time in the Navy, what was the best and or worst chow hall you ever went to?
All right. The best chow hall was in Kodiak, Alaska.
Oh, okay.
And we would do just like cold weather training up there. But it kind of like there wasn't really, it wasn't a big enough presence. I mean, first of all, they had like all these sick like snowmobiles and Ford Raptors. And they definitely had like too big of a budget.
Yeah.
But part of that went to, we hired a chef and we actually had to pay him. But out of the per diem, we just had this awesome chef that would like get like fresh fish from kind of there's great salmon and halibut out there and just cook for us every day. And it was so, so good. Some of the best food I've ever eaten.
Oh, that's incredible, man. My very last thing that I did in the Army, I was a guest OC for one of our companies that got assigned to, I think it was East Coast team for a biggie training exercise they had. So we were all at a White Sands missile range, and whichever team it was, they brought their own cooks and chefs and everything. And I was like, oh my God, these guys eat great. That chow hall was kicking for the 3 weeks that I was there, with the culinary team from NSW. So you guys were eating all right over there.
Got it.
Well, cool, man. Hey, I appreciate you coming on. Lots of good stuff in here for the audience. So I just want to pass it back over to you for any last thoughts you want to give out to the crowd.
For sure. I think in addition to what I said before about the veteran community being very supportive and just reaching out and talking to people, I think that's huge. I wish I had more wise things to say. I don't think I have anything profound. But I would say maybe have a bias toward action. You know, I think I wouldn't end up, if I had just sat in the military thinking, what do I want to do when I get out? And if I think about it long and hard enough, I'll find the right thing. Then I wouldn't end up in the spot where I am now. You kind of have to go try things in order to figure out kind of what's best for you. And the second thing I'd say is there was a time when I was in the military and I thought the coolest thing to do was like finish the military and go to Harvard Law School. And those are the guys I look up to. And I think as I've gotten a little more space, the guys I look up to now more are the people who are like, maybe it would be cool to go to like that, get a job at the big company, making a lot of money, but I like where I live, or I want to go back to here where my family are from. And I'm just really passionate about like hunting, and I want to make like hunting clothing, 'cause that's what I want to do. I've grown to respect much more people who just know what they want to do and it's important to them. And it doesn't matter kind of what is traditionally successful or what other people want to do. You kind of, when you figure out for yourself, okay, this is what's important to me and I just want to pursue that, I just have a lot of respect for that.
I totally, totally agree with you. And we're probably, over-indexed as a population of people who have, very quote unquote successful, high paying, great labeled jobs and are actually secretly miserable. And probably way under indexed on people who don't have, the external trappings of something, but are totally satisfied with life and are just like loving what they're doing. I think there's some equilibrium. We got to all learn to reach there a little bit. But Jack, really appreciate your time today, man. A lot of good stuff in here and glad you come on and join the show. So for everyone still listening, please like, subscribe, leave a review, and I'll see you all next week. All right. Take care.